From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For a small but growing minority of Americans, it's no longer enough to eat locally and live sustainably. Shopping the farmer's market is nice, but say you want to take the next step.
I got kind of obsessed with getting off the grid as much as I could. So we decided to grow our own food, and we heat with wood and we cook with wood. And I know it sounds like Little House on the Prairie. Oh, this is going to be so hard. It isn't hard at all.
My wife started doing chores for neighbors, and one thing she did was milk a neighbor's goat. She brought home raw, fresh milk, still warm in its bottle. That's when we decided it was time to get our goats.
There was a time when folks used to work a factory job, or they worked at the blacksmith shop, or they were the town dentist, and they had a pig and some chickens in the backyard. And if we're striving for anything, it's to integrate those things.
Goat herding, chicken tending, vegetable farming? Call it eating off the grid. The appeal of growing your own food has definitely struck a nerve. In this hour, stories of urban refugees who've taken up farming. Cartoonist Linda Berry falls in love with her wood-fueled stove. Novelist Brad Kessler acquires a herd of goats. And writer Michael Perry takes on pigs.
The idea that I get to go out and talk about books and write books, and not 4 hours ago, I was in the pig pen. And I'm thrilled that things turned out that way.
When you think about it, it's really kind of astonishing that in less than a decade, Americans' ideas about what to eat and where to get food have changed dramatically. And at the forefront of the movement to turn the American diet green is writer Michael Pollan. His book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, helped spark a national conversation about the ethics and ecology of food choices. In his most recent book, In Defense of Food, he takes his argument one step further. Pollan told Steve Paulson that much of what's sold in America today as food isn't.
The modern supermarket has lately been taken over with all sorts of things that look like food, might even taste like food, but are really just edible food-like substances. You know, if you look at something like bread now, I mean, you can make bread with flour and water, a pinch of salt, a little bit of water. Now there are breads in the supermarket with 40 or 50 ingredients. Why is that? Well, they want it to last for a really long time. And to do that, you have to use the latest techniques of food science. And you also have to remove most of the nutrients from the food. Mm. Because the way you make something durable when it comes to food is to make it unappealing to microbes and bacteria and fungus. And, you know, I have a Twinkie on my shelf that I've had for 2 years.
In fact, one of your guidelines is if it doesn't rot, then you shouldn't eat it.
Yeah. This is a good rule of thumb, because what is rotting? I mean, rotting is, you know, other creatures deciding that, ooh, this is tasty. I'm going to have some of this too. And the reason none of these organisms want my Twinkie is because it's not very nutritious. And that's been true, you know, since we first learned how to make white flour. I mean, the reason white flour lasts on the shelves for years is because the bacteria have no interest in it, and the rats have no interest in it. And we should pay attention to them. You know, they know something about nutrition.
But it seems like there's a big difference between a Twinkie. I mean, I have no idea what a Twinkie is made of. And
you should read the ingredients sometime. It's it's really fascinating. It's actually meat. No, it does. It contains beef, oddly enough.
So vegetarians should not eat Twinkies.
It's okay, a very complex food.
Well, okay, there's the Twinkie on the one hand, and, you know, all these fabricated substances like that. And then there are the loaves of bread, on the other hand, or the pastas, which, yes, they may have a few extra ingredients that our grandmothers didn't have in their pasta. But are you really saying a lot of those things are also not food?
Yeah. I mean, low-carb pasta. Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at a label for low-carb pasta. Again, another food that could be made with one ingredient called wheat. Now it's got 6 or 7 because they want to substitute the wheat with all sorts of polysaccharides and forms of fiber to kind of give it fill without giving you any kind of insulin reaction from a normal carbohydrate. So to me, we should call that imitation spaghetti, not spaghetti. I'm not saying it's, you know, poison. It's not going to kill you, but it's not going to do what pasta does.
Now, you are incredibly hard on nutritionists. In fact, you say nutrition science has nothing important to teach us. That's a rather sweeping denunciation.
Well, you know, nutrition scientists are doing important work, and sooner or later they will figure out food and figure out exactly what's going on in food and what's going on in our bodies when we eat food. But they haven't gotten there yet. It's an important science, and, you know, I think we should fund it and we should encourage it and we should watch it with great interest. But to my mind, it's kind of like where surgery was in 1650. You know, it's interesting and promising, but not yet ready for prime time. You don't want those people operating on you quite yet. That's where we are with nutrition science. So far, they really don't understand what's going on in the soul of a carrot. They have some ideas, they have some theories, but very often they're proven wrong. And there are nutritionists who will admit this to you, who will tell you, look, this is a very difficult science to do. How do you compare two foods? You know, there are no placebos when it comes to food. You can't give people fake steak, you know, next to real steak to see what the effect is.
Part of what nutritionists have tried to do is they've tried to break down foods into their component parts and into their nutrients. And so you have, you know, so much vitamin C or vitamin D or omega-3 fatty acids and, you know, get enough of those good things and manufacture a new kind of food that will give us all that we need.
That's the idea. But the interesting and weird thing is that foods turn out to be more than their nutrient parts. And that very often when we isolate these nutrients, which we've been doing for, you know, 175 years, figuring out the key nutrient inside these foods, when you rip those nutrients from their food context, they suddenly don't behave in quite the same way. So, for example, we thought for a long time that beta-carotene, which is in a lot of vegetables, a lot of orange vegetables in particular, this helped protect against cancer, because we know these vegetables seem to help protect against cancer, so probably it was the beta-carotene. But as soon as you took that out of the food and put it in a supplement, it didn't work. In fact, in some cases, it increased the risk of cancer. So there was something else going on. The beta-carotene is perhaps working in relation to another plant substance, or maybe, you know, there are 40 other carotenes that get much less attention. Maybe it's one of them or some combination. Or maybe a food is more than the sum of its nutrient parts. Maybe there are various synergies going on.
Now, you say the real culprit here is the Western diet. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, all this chatter about nutrients really obscures what I think is the elephant in the room. And one of the things we do know with some certainty about eating and health is that the Western diet, which is to say this diet of highly processed food, refined grain, lots of free sugars and added fat, lots of meat, and very little fresh fruit and vegetables and whole grain, that that American fast food diet reliably causes chronic diseases. And that before that diet was widely adapted, the incidence of obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and a whole specific set of diet-related cancers were virtually unheard of. And as you watch populations eating traditional diets adapt that Western diet, we see them get these diseases like clockwork.
Okay, well, let's talk about how we should eat then. You have a few guidelines. One is don't eat anything your great-grandmother would not recognize as food.
Yeah, I'm basically trying with the kinds of rules of thumb that I offer in this book to help people escape the Western diet without actually having to leave civilization and join the Maasai or the Aborigines, which doesn't strike me as practical. So I come up with these kind of more cultural rather than scientific rules of thumb. And the example you cite is, it's kind of a mental test. You know, imagine you're in the supermarket, you're rolling down the aisle, and your great-grandmother is with you. And you pick up the Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes. Does she recognize that as food? She probably doesn't even know how to get the stuff into her body from the tube. I mean, what is that exactly? Is it toothpaste? Doesn't look like food. And then she reads the label. And, you know, she knows that yogurt is basically milk in a bacterial culture. But there are 10 or 15 different things that have nothing to do with milk or bacteria on that label. So I don't think she recognizes that as food. And I think the supermarket is full of things like that.
Do you tend to read labels when you go into a grocery store?
For laughs, mostly. I do. I mean, I do read labels, but...
I mean, does that determine whether you buy something or not?
Occasionally it will. I mean, one of my rules is, you know, don't buy foods with more than 5 ingredients. Or don't buy foods with ingredients that you can't pronounce. Or don't buy foods whose ingredients include high fructose corn syrup. Not because high fructose corn syrup is necessarily a satanic nutrient, as a lot of people do, but because it's a real marker of a highly processed food. I mean, who do you know who cooks with high fructose corn syrup? So these are kind of all algorithms to help you sort out the food from the edible food-like substances. Another tip of mine that is a little bit counterintuitive is I also recommend that if you're concerned about your health, avoid foods that make health claims. And, you know, if you think about it, the foods that carry health claims tend to be packaged foods because you need a package to put the health claim on. You also need a big marketing budget to get it out there and a science budget to do the research to satisfy the FDA. And these health claims are usually based on erroneous science or sketchy science. It's not hard to get a health claim on a food. And the real problem, I'm not saying that it's poison, but, you know, the really healthy foods are the ones that are very quiet over in the produce section.
Now, it seems to me your basic philosophy is that we should eat, if possible, organic, locally grown foods, mainly plants, but some meat would fall into that category as well.
Yes.
And I have to say, I try to do that myself, but one thing you quickly notice is that this comes at a price. I mean, this food is typically much more expensive than what you get at the supermarket. And it does raise the question of elitism here, whether that is an inherent part of this philosophy of eating.
It's a very legitimate question. The fact is, to eat well in this country, to eat healthy food, costs more. And that's a shameful situation. You know, right now, the cheapest calories in the supermarket are the calories of added fat and added sugar that are in the middle sections. If you've got a dollar to spend on food and you don't have a lot of money and you're in the market for calories, you can get 1,250 calories in the processed food aisles. And if you go over to produce, you can only get 250 calories. This is the result of the agricultural policies we have in this country, though, which subsidize the growing of corn and soybeans, which are the building blocks of all the fast food. So we need to level the playing field. We have to make the healthy calories more competitive with the unhealthy calories. Food is very cheap in this country, and I would argue it's too cheap. I would also argue that it's not really as cheap as it looks, because when the food is cheap, you end up paying more in health care. And as we've watched the price of food fall in this country in real dollars, we're only spending about 9% of our annual income on food. That's down from 18% when I was a boy in 1960. In that same period, the amount we're spending on health care has soared from 5% to 16 or 17%. So you see, this money we're supposedly saving in food, we're spending on health care. And I would just, you know, I would much rather spend it on food than on dialysis.
There has been, of course, a lot of talk along the lines of what you've been saying here for the last, couple of decades at least. Do you see a real change in the way Americans are eating? I mean, can we talk about a revolution in how we eat in this country?
Yeah. I don't know if I'd use the word revolution quite yet, but there are a lot of changes afoot. I am really struck by the rise of local foods, the popularity of organic foods, the return of pasture-based meat production. There is an incredible movement going on around food in this country. And it's not something that the politicians have yet recognized, but it is happening. People are very worried about what they see, the public health crisis around food that we face. They're worried about their children. And there's a discontent with the food, too, that it's just, you know, not as good as it should be. So I'm very encouraged. This would have been the manifesto of a crackpot 40 years ago. I mean, to eat the way I'm talking about, you know, well-grown food from good soils, you'd have to go back to the land and grow it yourself. Now you can go to the farmer's market. Now you can join a CSA and subscribe to a farm and get a box of, you know, really good produce every week. So we live in very good times, too. We have options. We have choices. We're not stuck with the Western diet anymore.
Writer Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You'll never find anyone as passionate about food as the person who grows it. It's one reason more and more of us are shopping at farmers markets these days, for the chance to see what's in season, do a little sampling, and meet the growers themselves.
Carol Knapp, Knapp's Fresh Veggies from West Bend. We specialize in tomatoes and winter squash and Brussels sprouts and stuff like that. We do a lot of heirlooms. We have well over 100 heirlooms, things you can't buy the seeds in the store. I joined a group last winter called Tomatoville, and they're big into the seed saving.
Bigger ones are
I traded for over 100 new varieties, varieties new to me this year. This is Cherry Roma, which is a grape variety, but dates back to the 1800s. This not-so-appetizing-looking strange green one is called Green Doctors. It's what's called a green one ripe, and it's very tasty, more so than you'd think. I think this one's the Mini Carol Yellow. It's a variety that was actually been discontinued, and I've been saving the seeds for years. Okay, that's our Sun Sugar. Everybody loves the Sun Sugar Sun Golds, and they have just been so slow to ripen this year. We had 3 pints this week. That's it. You know, they're just not doing much for me anyway. It's been difficult to grow much of anything this year other than weeds.
I'm Dale Marsden. This is Marsden's Pure Honey. I have wildflower, buckwheat, and purple loosestrife honey today. That's what I have this time of the year. Early in the spring, I have dandelion and locust honey and sometimes Russian olive. I just got the buckwheat honey, and that's kind of it's like the taste of raisins in raisin bread. It's kind of that nice caramely flavor of raisins, cooked raisins. And then the purple loosestrife is from northern Wisconsin. It's an invasive, but they make good honey. It's sort of a real fruity, tangy flavor. It's from the flower. Every flower has sort of a different flavor. And some honeys, the pollen adds to that if there's a lot of pollen in the honey. I run about 50 hives of bees a year, and I've been doing this for 45 years.
Sounds from the Dane County Farmers Market, one of the largest farmers markets in the nation. Just happens to be a few blocks from our studios.
Early June. The mountains turn tender green this time of year. The skies become enamel blue. The goats wear bells around their necks while we hike up Mason's Hill.
Writer Brad Kessler.
There's 8 of us here today, 7 goats, 1 human. We step through salad greens, and the goats taste everything in sight. Steeplebush, wild strawberries, buttercups, blackberry vines. We're heading to the mountains soon. Each day we wander the Vermont woods for an hour or two. I love the leave-taking, the sound of the goats' bells, the brief nomadism. Herding is a way of doing something while doing nothing. It asks only for one's presence, awake, watching animals and earth. This evening, I'll milk the does back in the barn, and when the sun goes down, I'll make an aged cheese from their milk called a tome. Months from now, when snow covers the mountains, I'll open that tome and find this day again inside its rind, the aromatic grass, the leaves, this wind. I've been following these goats back home each day, but where they lead surprises me still. I want to take you there.
A few years ago, writer Brad Kessler knew absolutely nothing about goats or herding or farming or making cheese. He grew up in the suburbs. He made his living as a writer in New York City. But life has a way of surprising us. Today, Brad Kessler is still a writer, but he's also the owner of 75 acres in Vermont and a small herd of goats. In his new book, Goat Song, he writes about what it's like to live intimately with animals that directly feed you, and he traces the pastoral roots of much of our Western culture.
There is this wonderful tradition and culture of pastoralism, starting with the domestication of ungulates. So we have about a 10,000-year history of living with goats, or later sheep, and still later cows. What came out of this was pastoral poetry. Certainly our religious motifs came out of this. Elements of our economy and certainly our diet came out of it. So all of us in the West have this past, this human past, as herders. Reach back in your family somewhere and somebody was herding a goat or a cow.
How did this happen to you? Because you were, as you say, a child of the suburbs. You were, in fact, a writer, weren't you? Married to a photographer living in Manhattan? That's a long way from 75 acres and goats in Vermont.
Right. But we never really felt truly at home in the city, more so myself. And we finally found an abandoned farmhouse in southwestern Vermont that had 75 acres. And we started with a big garden. And we had been there for about 5 years before my wife started doing, well, she started doing chores for neighbors. And one thing she did was milk a neighbor's goat. And she brought home milk, raw, fresh milk, still warm in its bottle. And I experimented with making cheese. And one thing I made was a fresh chèvre. And if you've ever had a fresh chèvre made only, you know, that tasted only hours after it's been made with unpasteurized milk, it's a revelation. It felt like we were eating not a cheese, but a meadow.
I think that's something that most of us who haven't experienced can't understand, that cheese is, it comes in a wide variety, but I have the feeling it's nothing like what you're talking about.
Well, particularly a fresh chèvre, which is, in this country, it's illegal to sell, because if you have a raw, unpasteurized cheese, you have to age it for 2 months or longer in order to sell it. So it felt like we were making moonshine, in a sense, because we would make the chèvre and we couldn't sell it, and we could barely give it away because that, too, is somewhat illegal. But it tasted like nothing we'd ever had before. It didn't taste anything like what you find, you know, in a vacuum-sealed package called chèvre. Again, it was just so different that that's when we decided it was time to get our goats. I mean, we just realized that...
You didn't want that to be a one-time experience.
Exactly.
You know, this is something that people clearly knew once and don't know anymore. This history, though, of herding goats, of caring for goats, is fascinating in other ways. I was particularly interested in how much of our history, our writing history, our alphabetic history, is associated with raising animals.
Right. One of the things I discovered was that the pictographic origins of our alphabet, which comes from the Roman, which goes to the Etruscan, which goes back to the Phoenician or the Hebrew, in their design, if you take the letter A, for example, the capital letter, Roman A, and you turn it upside down, well, there's an ox that comes from the Hebrew Aleph, which means ox. If you take the C and turn it on its side, it's a camel's hump, and the C comes from Gimel, which in Hebrew means camel, and so on. The letter H means a fence, and the letter I is a herding staff. And it's curious that a lot of our writing came out of some of the earliest writing ever found came out of Mesopotamia, is contemporaneous with the start of animal herding. So from the very start, there was this relationship between, you know, herding and writing.
You make all this sound so logical, so natural, and yet, when the time came, I gather that the naturalness of it was maybe more than you expected.
Right. I mean, the actual day-to-day physical work and the husbandry of birthing, you know, breeding the goats and then birthing the kids and then doing the human trickery involved with getting the milk from the lactating animal. Yes, that was certainly something that we needed to learn, and we had neighbors who helped us, we had other farmers, and we had books. And we failed sometimes, but ultimately we succeeded and we learned how to do it.
On the other hand, you had that milk then and were able to do finally what you'd always wanted to do, which was to have your own goat cheese. Do you still remember that first cheese?
I remember the first time we made the cheese from our own milk. Yes, I mean, it was a revelation.
What was it like?
Well, I think when you produce something from your own land with your own hands and with an animal that you are intimate with, who you have this relationship, this incredibly intimate relationship with, and you know each other, and they've been eating things that you know, and every step of the way is something that you are, again, intimate with, there's this amazing feeling of communion, not only with the animal, not only with the land, but with everything around you. And it does feel like you're, you know, eating this part of the earth or this sense of place. I mean, a piece of cheese is nothing if not a sense of place, a raw milk cheese, because it's informed by the very microbes and bacteria that's in the air as it ages. So you can't replicate a particular cheese that's made, say, in Vermont. You can't do that in Wisconsin. The Geotrichum candidum, which is, you know, one of the bacteria that colonize, actually it's a fungus that colonizes the cheese, is going to be different in my part of Vermont versus someone who lives 20 miles away. So it's this wonderful uniqueness that that place offers.
It was just one of many things that you discovered that year. There's a place in the book that I wonder if you'd read for us. It's about seeing the world in a different way. I think you call it the milk diary, a daily record you started
right.
keeping. It turned into a kind of meditation for you, I gather.
There's two things. I mean, the word dairy and diary are stubbornly unrelated etymologically, and yet they seemed, there were the two things I did every day. I wrote and I milked. And so, you know, it was a sort of offloading of, in one case, it was milk. In the other case, you know, it was words. And in this milk diary, It's a daily record of how much milk we get and what happens with the goats, but it also becomes a meditation on the notion of paradise.
It's funny to hear you talk about paradise, because all of the times you talk about how lovely it is to go walking with the goats, there are also all of these times when it sounds like a really messy business.
Right. Well, paradise is originally, you know, the definition of paradise is a fenced place. I mean, that's the basic definition. And of course, that what do you do in that fence? Well, you either have a garden, you have, a paradise garden, or you have animals. What I need to just explain briefly is that you find at the middle of the word paradise this Indo-European root day, which means to knead, and it's also the root for the word dairy. So in this milk diary, I'm sort of going through the history of ideas about paradise, and finally at the end, discovering what is at the root of the word, which actually I'll reveal. I could just read it and reveal it in the text.
Would you please?
Yeah. July 30th. Today again, this lovely wind. The meadows plunge like waves. Trees toss their heads. The pasture turns to swells. We don't have enough words in English for our winds. Boreas, Zephyr, Santa Ana, Squamish, Chinook. We need one here in New England. A local wind god. He comes this time of year, an ocean-faring breeze that brings hammered blue skies, clear mornings, fringed gentians, yellow hollyhocks, a constant seething in the dark. He makes these days seem so impermanent, a rock we cling to for a little while before scraped into the deep. The milkings continue to pleasure. Nobody leaps the line. Before it was a chore, but now a meditation, the Hebrew amida, silence the most important part. During my morning milkings, no one talks. The animals like their routine. They won't tolerate noise or visitors or novelty. The only sounds, a song or breath, and the squirts of milk and the clank of the gate being closed. The calmer and more focused I become, the calmer grow the goats. We live in exile not from paradise, but from the present. How often do we dwell there? How often does a wind bring us back? Morning, 1.5 gallons. Evening, 3/4 gallons. August 1st. Maybe paradise is all these things. A garden, an enclosed park, the memory of mother's milk, or a golden age. Maybe the garden is within, or exists in the holiness of daily labor, the body making food for itself. Or maybe it surrounds us every second, if only we open our eyes. Could it be that the word day, at the root of the word paradise, was, in fact, a dairy, a place where people learn to milk other animals? Morning, 1.5 gallons. Evening, 1 gallon. Maidshev from 4 gallons.
Brad Kessler is the author of Goat Song, A Seasonal Life, A Short History of Herding, and the Art of Making Cheese. He lives and farms in Vermont.
Getting in the cows, shoe them in the barn. Put them in the stanchion, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. A month on the dairy for the check to come in. Well, I start my day in the sun up dark. I'm going down the lane to bring my milk cows up. I got a Holstein and a Jersey and a one-eyed steer. An old brown cow with jumps fences like a deer. Dew's on the ground and my feet all wet. I got a light on my hand, hat on my head. Down to the pasture to get my herd. Just chewing their cud and looking at the birds.
Coming up, cartoonist Linda Berry goes off the grid in rural Wisconsin. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you took a stroll around your local farmer's market this weekend, what might you find? Depends on where you live, but here's what's growing in our backyard.
These are ground cherries. It's an heirloom berry, been around for hundreds of years. Back in the day, they used to make pies, jams, jellies out of, and kind of rare today. They actually, well, they've been around here for hundreds of years, but people know them under quite a few different names. Cape gooseberries, and I can't say the Latin name, but Physalis or Physalis something. And what else are they called? The berries themselves, to me, taste like pineapple mango. And the pie is just this fabulous, undescribable pineapple-y thing. So it's good. It's very good. Very odd. They have the husk on. People have asked if my husband wraps them every morning, and yes, he does. No, he doesn't. But it takes a while to get the husks off and make a pie out of them, but it's worth it. Mary Evans, Evans Family Farm, Afton, Wisconsin.
I do. My name is Willie Lehner from Bluemont Dairy. My best cheeses are my cave-age cheeses. They're wrapped in paper. These are cured in my underground vault that's to simulate cave conditions. And it takes a good cheese and makes it magnificent. My claim to fame, if you want to put it that way, is my bandage cheddar, which has these Parmesan-y crunchy notes to it, caramely. It's quite awesome. You almost have to forget that you're eating cheddar because it doesn't taste like cheddar anymore. My Erzschmier cheese, it's my own creation. That's a real stinky cheese. It's like beyond Limburger. It's skanky. It's even over the top for me. You want to try? You want? Okay, I've got to go get that. I'm going to cut you some from the center. See, it gets downright, it turns fluid. I have people pick up a piece of that, and I said, have you had this kind of cheese before? And they say, no. I said, let me give you a taste first before you commit to it. On this one, this is a wash-drying cheese where the outside of the cheese, I inoculate it with bacteria and yeast to, The bacteria that's used to make this is the same bacteria that's used to make your feet stinky. My European, German, French clientele love this stuff. I give them a taste, they go, oh my God. We're in a country that doesn't have good cheese, and then taste this, and they go, all right. You can just stick it right on there. You don't have to eat it. It's not for everybody. You won't hurt my feelings.
What makes a dedicated urban dweller decide to swap her subway pass for a tractor? For writer and cartoonist Linda Barry, it was love. Barry's best known for her long-running weekly comic strip Ernie Pook's Comique, and for her book and off-Broadway play The Good Times Are Killing Me. She is a bluntly outspoken left-wing writer with an urban sensibility who now lives off the grid in rural Wisconsin. Steve Paulson wondered how that happened.
I was actually born in a rural area. I was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin. And my husband does prairie restoration, and his specialty is oak savannas, of which there's almost none left. And he wanted to move to a place where he could have his nursery. And I always liked nature when I was a kid. I loved it. I mean, I'm kind of a nature fiend, and especially fungus in particular. I really love fungus. So he found this little place. He came home and he said, I found our place. I said, what's the house like? And he said, there are oaks from before the Civil War. I cannot believe it. There are oaks before the Civil War. I said, what's the house like? He goes, there is a barn that was built in the 1880 something. I said, okay, what's the house like? And he said, there is a little shed where you can turn into a studio. And I said, what's the house like? And he goes, well, as a house, it's not that great, but if you think of it as a tricked out trailer, it's incredible.
And he sold you on this?
Well, it surely is one of those. You know, when you're driving down the highway, sometimes you'll see half of a house going by. Do you know what I'm talking about? And
sure,
then you see the other half.
Yeah.
And then there's a truck with a big super glue tube, you know, and they put it together. It's one of those houses where I just go, I could never stand to live there. But once it turns out, once you're inside one of those houses, you can't tell. Doesn't matter.
But here you were. You'd been living in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
So, and you go into the Wisconsin countryside to live on a farm in an old shed? That sounds like a pretty big transition.
You know, it not at all, not even kind of a transition, mostly because I realize, I mean, I'm somebody that spends most of my time alone anyway at a drawing table, so it kind of doesn't matter where the drawing table is. I have friends who, because they haven't spent time in the country, don't know people who live in rural areas. I don't know what they assume. They think it's like Green Acres or something. But they assume, like there was a guy who was interviewing me for the Chicago Tribune, and he kept saying, "Don't you miss intellectual conversations?" And I'm like, like, you think only people in the city, after, as soon as you drive out of the city, you're, you know, all I can talk about is, I mean, it's so interesting to me because the quality of conversation and friendship I have where I live now, there's no difference whatsoever, except for now I'm friends with people who can pull a calf, you know, if a cow's, or I mean, I'm friends with people who can do all this, to me, really amazing stuff that none of my friends in Chicago could do.
Is this a working farm? And do you grow your own food?
Yeah, we grow our own food. And I got kind of obsessed with getting off the grid as much as I could. You know, both Kevin, my husband, and I are hardcore environmentalists. So we decided to give up our dryer. If you live in Wisconsin, hanging clothes out when it's 10 below zero is commitment. But I'll tell you some amazing stuff about it. If you're fast enough, the clothes iron themselves. They freeze so quickly that if there's a wind, I've hung up a pair of pants where they froze so quickly there was a wind and then they come up and hit your face like cardboard.
Yeah, but do they dry?
Yeah, they do. They absolutely dry. They freeze dry. Huh. But they absolutely dry. So there's that. And then we decided, Kevin does a whole lot of, you know, he does restoration, and he noticed there was so much wood that when things are thinned out or people pull out their hedgerows, wood that was not being used, and they would just burn it on site. And so he thought, well, let's see what can we heat with wood and cook with wood, especially this wood that's going to be burned anyway. So we do. We heat with wood and we cook with wood. And I know it sounds like Little House on the Prairie. Oh, this is going to be so hard. It isn't hard at all. We have an old cook stove that's from, I guess it's like 1910 or 1920. And it has a little firebox. And you just put sticks in there, light them on fire, and you can cook right on it.
Is this your only source of heat for their house?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's the wood.
Yeah, we have a cook stove inside, and then we have an outdoor wood boiler. So they're amazing. They have a huge firebox. You can get a stump in there.
So has this experience changed you? I mean, this whole move to the country, are you in some ways a different Linda Berry now?
Absolutely. And this is how it's changed me. When I was living in the city, my friends were like-minded. You know, they were people that were like-minded. And I always say that I'm a hardcore liberal. I spell liberal with 47 L's. Liberal, you know, left, left, left. And I realized I had never had friends who had different political views. And I had never had friends that had different religious experiences. I mean, I had when I was little. When you're little, you do. And now I'm in a community that is really varied. And there's a lot of conservative. My best friends are very conservative evangelical Christians. And I would have never in a million years thought I could be best friends, you know, with, I mean, you know what I mean? I just never thought it could happen. And I hadn't realized till I got to know a whole bunch of different kinds of people that I was closed-minded. Because liberals can't be, you know, I mean, it's physically impossible. And so I was saying that to a friend of mine. I said, I had no idea that I was closed-minded. And she said, I think that's the definition of closed-minded. So I've really become much more open-minded.
We're hearing a lot these days about people who fit your demographic profile, lived in the city, liberal politics, highly educated. For whatever reason, they move into the country and kind of do the back to the land thing. Do you consider yourself part of a movement in a way?
No, I consider myself somebody who fell in love with a prairie restorationist. But it's definitely Kevin. It's his job really requires him to be, and he wants to be in the landscape. And through him, and that's the beautiful thing about love, this whole other world has opened up to me. And I'm telling you, if I was 23 or 24 when I was a little, I don't know what was happening then. It was past punk rock, but I was a hardcore punk rocker. First, I was a young hippie, then a punk rocker, then I don't know what new wave, whatever happened. I would go crazy thinking that this is what my life is like. You know, it'd be like Edward Munch the Scream if both of us, you know, if I could have seen. In fact, a dear friend of mine, I mean, I have lots of friends who just can't imagine how I can stand it. And then they come out and visit me, and then they don't want to leave, you know. So it's beautiful. And it's beautiful to grow your own food. It's beautiful to cook with wood. It's beautiful to have eggs from the neighbor where you actually know the chicken. You know, so that part is really wonderful. And quiet. It's very, very beautifully quiet. And very starry skies at night.
Cartoonist Linda Berry talking with Steve Paulson. Her most recent graphic novel is called What It Is. She also makes really good strawberry rhubarb jam. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Last seen sleeping off his wedding night in the back of a 1951 International Harvester pickup truck, writer Michael Perry is now living in a rickety farmhouse on 37 acres, along with four pigs, dozens of chickens, and his wife and two little girls. Perry's last book was a much-acclaimed memoir called Truck, A Love Story. His newest is called Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting. He told Ann Strange Champs that America does seem to be in the midst of another back-to-the-land movement, with a few key differences.
My one memory of the back-to-the-land movement of the 70s, I was a pretty small tyke back then, but old enough to remember this pretty clearly, is that we had a group of folks who moved in, and they, as I recall, they bought three farms in a triangulated relationship, roughly, to my father's farm. And they announced that they were going to commit agriculture in a communal manner. And this involved equipment sharing, which meant they spent most of their time just running from farm to farm with their equipment. And I remember during haying season one time, they came by for about the seventh time that day, and they would hook all their gear together. Their tractor would be hooked to the mower, hooked to the rake, hooked to the baler, hooked to a hay wagon, hooked to another hay wagon, and there'd be various communal members sprawled around the equipment, and they would go back and forth and back and forth. And on this particular day during haying season, they went by for about their sixth or seventh time, and my father just stood there. He was a quiet man, not a man to say anything nasty about anyone, but a man of some wry observation. And as they slowly disappeared into the woods on our little country road there, he just watched, and then he said, wonder how long that's going to last. And of course, in that specific instance, it really didn't. My observation, and I'm not an expert, this is just me talking here, but is that, yes, it is happening again, but it seems to be happening, and this is where I take some hope, in a more realistic way, smaller steps. We're a perfect example. Boy, my wife and I, we're not at the cutting edge of anything. We wouldn't pretend to be. We're just taking little steps, trying to raise more and more of our own food. Even at our small level, we have to constantly pull back and realize, no, you know what? Six pigs is too many. Let's get four again.
Well, you and your wife both grew up on farms, so I guess you must not have had too romanticized a vision of what small farming could be.
Not at all. That really helped. My wife grew up on a truck farm. Her stepfather raised beef cattle. And I grew up on your standard small dairy farm, red barn, black and white cows. Both of us knew what true farming entailed. That helped. Nonetheless, you still get in over your head because you have a vision of what you'd like to do, and you find out that that vision requires a whole lot of work and, above all, a whole lot of presence. Day after day.
So what was your vision? What made you and your wife want to move back to the land? Because you're a writer, you've worked as an EMT, you've trained as a nurse. You know, you didn't have to do this.
Well, I've always wanted to move out into the country, although I go to great lengths right in the beginning of Coop to say that I hope I can be the kind of parent who doesn't confuse my children with the idea that rural equals righteous. I mean, one of the neat things we're seeing now are things like the urban chicken movement. You don't have to move out to a farm. Mm-hmm. But because I was raised on a farm and I liked the country, I always in the back of my mind hoped I'd end up back on a farm. Now we have a bunch of ducks and we got about 80 chickens, some meat chickens, some laying hens, some new laying hen chicks. We've got I just picked up 4 pigs yesterday, and I was up at midnight in the rain carrying them one by one out of the mud into the hutch because they haven't learned what the hutch is yet. And so at midnight, I was carrying muddy feeder pigs against my chest.
Okay, this is the point at which a lot of people would say, you know what, maybe this farming thing is not quite what I bargained for. Well, maybe this is a little more work.
Yeah, I think that's part of the humor and the seriousness of it. You realize that it's 11:30 at night, it's bugging me, I wonder if the pigs came in from the rain. And so the serious part is the husbandry. You really must get up and go check on your animals. And so I went out there, and sure enough, they were all piled up on each other and out in the rain getting pelted. And so I had to get them in. And there, as far as I could see, I tried to herd them a little bit, and it was just a complete train wreck. And so I said, well,
you can't herd pigs?
Not well, not in an open space like that. So I just started picking them up one by one and carrying them in, and I put them in a corner, and then I went in the house and I stayed up for an hour and read a little bit and went back out to check to make sure they'd stayed in there. And when I shone the light in, it was wonderful because they were all over in a dried corner, back in a big pile, sound asleep, literally snoring. So then I could go back to bed with a feeling of inner peace because the pigs were dry and happy.
So at moments like that, do you think, why don't we just move back to town and buy our bacon in the supermarket like everybody else? Or do you think, wow, life is good?
Oh, no, I love it. But also the payoff is that we will have bacon at the end of the year, and it's going to taste really good because my buddy Bob, the one-eyed beagle, the local butcher, is going to smoke it for me, and I'm going to know where it came from, and the kids help feed it. And I can't stress enough, we are at best boutique farmers. I mean, the person who really is struggling is the person who's got a herd of milk cows and trying to figure out how they're going to feed their kids on the current price of milk.
You actually wound up investing in the pigs before the chickens, am I right?
Yeah, I got the pigs first because I had then, once we knew we were moving to the farm, I had started reading about pigs and they sounded pretty cool. And my brothers had raised pigs and I found them interesting. And my dad wouldn't have a pig on the farm. He didn't like the way they smelled. When we got our pigs, I was a little concerned, first of all, about my daughter, because the day I brought them home and I let them loose in the pen, they went grunting off and started digging and rolling in the dirt. And my daughter said, oh, they're cute. And they were. And she said, I'm going to call that one Wilbur and that one's Cocklebur. And I had to explain to her, you know, honey, in October we'll butcher the pigs and they're going to be our food in the winter. And she said, I know. But I wasn't sure if she really got it. But a couple of weeks later, some city relatives came to visit and she took them down to show them the pigs. And when I walked down there, I arrived just as she was saying to them, well, that one's Wilbur and that one's Cocklebur. But in October, that one's ham and that one's bacon. And so I figured she was clear on the concept.
You have a story about butchering day, which I was thinking, you know, your daughter was 6 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And even if she understood that the pigs were theoretically going to be butchered, actually having the butcher arrive and the pigs killed might be traumatic, but she turned out to be pretty hard-hearted about it.
I chickened out because when he came to butcher them, we had them butchered right on the farm there. I just thought, you know, I don't really want to have her watch this process. And I had her in the house, and this butcher, this one-handed butcher, this great character, he asked me, he had already killed the pigs and he was starting to cut them up. And he said, where's your daughter? He knew I had a daughter. And I said, well, I have her in the house. He goes, well, I think that's a mistake. And so I went in the house and I asked her, I said, you can come out if you want. And then this gentleman, this butcher, turned this into an amazing exercise in anatomy and physiology. He went through that whole pig and he showed her the parts, talked about how they worked, compared them to how a human functions. And she was fascinated. And he was right. At the end of the day, it was a great experience for her.
I think I remember he said, who's going to crawl inside?
Well, yeah, he has a joke he does with all kids who watch him butcher when he has the pig and he's ready to eviscerate it. He says, who's shortest here? And the little kid puts her hand up and she goes, you got boots on? She says, yes. And he basically then says, oh, because I need you to crawl up in there and push the guts out. And she just kind of looked at me and then she eventually grinned. She got the joke. And again, that's the kind of thing where I think maybe in the description it sounds horrifying, but in the moment, it was just part of the deal. This guy was great. You know, he made a huge impression on her.
Now, along with the livestock, the baby pigs and the chicks, you also wound up assisting in the home birth of your own daughter.
Yeah, we moved into this old farmhouse. I call it a slantways farmhouse. It's out at the end of a dead-end road, and there's a fairly long driveway, and the house is originally a log cabin built in the 1880s. And we were in that old house in the middle of winter, and my wife said she wanted to have the baby in that house. My response was to say, ha, 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 in a real high-pitched way, and then her gaze hardened, and I realized she was serious. So we started to go see a midwife, and we prepared and got a birthing tub, and I write pretty openly in the book that I had some pretty deep reservations, and I wasn't entirely in favor of it, but I trust my wife, and I love my wife, and I could see it was what she wanted, and in the end, it was a wonderful experience.
So how do you find time for writing on top of, I mean, farming is notoriously sunrise to sunset. When do you write?
Oh, again, please let me stress. I make my living writing magazine articles and books. I have in my wife a partner who agreed to a certain lifestyle, and she is everything to me, and none of this would happen without her. I guess what I'm saying is I don't necessarily see a separation. Obviously, the writing is where I give the preponderance of my focus because that's what pays the rent. But what I like about what's happening now is you're seeing folks get six chickens for their backyard and their own eggs, or folks like us who are, we're not pig farmers. We raise four pigs a year. But we're integrating that. And that's where I think, you know, there's this whole idea that you're either a farmer or you're not a farmer, or you're a writer or you're nothing else, or you work as an accountant and you're nothing else. Well, there was a time when folks used to work a factory job, or they worked at the blacksmith shop, or they were the town dentist, and they had a pig and some chickens in the backyard. And so I think that's, if we're striving for anything, it's to integrate those things, you know, and not necessarily for my kids to grow up and say, I was raised on a farm. But for my kids to say, when we were kids, we had pigs and chickens.
And to say, my dad made up his life the way he wanted it.
Yeah, I will say that is part of it. The idea that I get to go out and talk about books and write books and travel and then come home. And I mean, you and I are talking not 4 hours ago. I was in the pig pen. And I'm thrilled that things turned out that way. Grateful.
Writer Michael Perry is the author of Truck, A Love Story, and most recently Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps.
Oh, I like to rise when the sun, she rises early in the morning. I like to hear them small birds singing merrily upon their layland. And to hurrah for the life of country kid, and to ramble in the new mown hay.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you've got a question or comment about today's show, you can email us through our website, where you will also find book and music listings and a link to our weekly podcast. It's ttbook.org. Or visit our Facebook page. Become a fan. If you want a copy of today's show, you can buy one from the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Back to the Farm program, number 104A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Anne Strainchamps put this hour together with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Brad Kohlberg engineered today.
PRI, Public Radio International.